What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 779 days since October 7th, 2023, and in that time, the Palestinian people have endured over 2 years of constant bombardment estimated to equal roughly six times the explosive force of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945, concentrated on an area less than half the size of the Japanese city. All hospitals and universities have been bombed, most homes and schools destroyed, and vital infrastructure such as the sewage system and electricity lines have been damaged beyond repair. An estimated 50 million tons of rubble is strewn across the strip, and under it lie at least 10,000 bodies of murdered Palestinians who are yet to be recovered. According to Gaza's government media office, Israel has violated the so-called ceasefire of Trump's 20-point so-called peace plan nearly 500 times in 44 days, murdering 342 civilians. The deadliest day so far was October 29th, when the Israeli occupation forces murdered 109 Palestinians, including 52 children. More recently, on Thursday, 32 Palestinians were murdered, including an entire family in the Zetouan neighborhood of Gaza City when a bomb was dropped in a building they were sheltering in. The starvation continues along with the bombing. 600 trucks of aid were supposed to be allowed in each day, but the IOF has permitted only 150 trucks a day to cross into the strip, despite aid agencies saying they have enough food ready to go to feed the people of Gaza for months. They are also preventing the entry of nutritious food, including meat, dairy, and vegetables, as well as much-needed medicine, tents, and other materials for shelter. They are doing this in the dead or the beginning of severe weather conditions, winter in Gaza, which we will repeatedly remind people about over the next couple of months, as I imagine we will continue to have this conversation. To discuss this, as well as the latest on Lebanon, is Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration. Good morning, Curry.
Morning, Kat.
I prepare to talk to you, and in real spirit, I'm like, what new can I ask?
Right. Well, I want to start by saying the context that you just gave for this horror, that is how you introduce the question of Gaza. You know, that's the context that all journalists should be offering. And instead, what we're hearing each day of Israeli violation of this so-called ceasefire, which is every day, each day it's covered as though it's a new thing, you know, a new kind of occurrence, or that the only context is that there is a what they call a shaky ceasefire, as opposed to a ceasefire that Israel has violated 500 times. You know, it inevitably reminds me not to stray far from the subject of Gaza and Palestine, but when the police kill a black person, you know, the media covers it as though it's like a new thing, devoid of context of all the other black folks that police have killed, or the decades, dare I say, centuries of black folks being killed by authorities. So I just want to appreciate the context that you're offering. And that said, you know, on one hand, yes, this feels all very familiar. You know, this feels like, and without accepting the kind of mundaneness of Israeli violence against Palestinians, it feels like another day in a string of violent days of Israeli colonization and Israeli violence. And what I've been sitting with, and what I want to talk about, is how actually we are, and really the people of Gaza are first, but then all of us, entering a new phase here. What they are doing is not just killing more Palestinians as they've been doing, but they are using this particular set of violence that they're carrying out right now to further destabilize the rights that Palestinians have claimed to, and to make the whole world a more dangerous place. You know, when you redefine what ceasefire means again and again in Gaza, but as you said, in Lebanon, where for over a year after the signing of a so-called ceasefire, Israel has violated it. What they are doing is redefining the term ceasefire. And how they arrived at these so-called, at the ceasefire, it was, you know, a ceasefire is supposed to be an agreement between two parties that are armed. We'll ignore for 1 second the wild power imbalance, you know, of an occupying colonizing power and a people facing colonization. Two armed forces enter an agreement to stop fighting. That's what a ceasefire is supposed to be. This was not that. This was the White House coming up with a deal, consulting their Israeli friends, and then imposing it on Palestinians. So, you know, the whole idea of what an agreement is even supposed to be, the idea of what a ceasefire is supposed to be, the U.S. and Israel are redefining, and that is extremely dangerous. And so I know that this, for us, you know, from this distance, there's a kind of fatigue of watching and witnessing, you know, the horror in Gaza every day. And that's real. And I think we have to pay attention to what they are doing right now, because they are trying to open a new era of violence.
And I just want to say, before I continue my line of questioning or conversation with you, it's not that there's ever a thought to stop having Palestine posts. Like, if I have to get on here and repeat the same thing over and over again and have the same conversation with you for another 5, that's what we're going to do, right? Yeah. We're never going to stop sounding the alarm bells. It's more along the line, maybe this is self-centered, it's more along the line of, is what is helpful? You know what I mean? Like, what actually serves the mission of having this conversation, which is to challenge the mainstream narrative and inspire people to get engaged in order to stop this genocide.
That's right. Can I just say one thing about that before? And I know that you got questions, but just, yeah. I think that this, the fact that you do this every Monday, it's so important for many reasons. One is because there's all kinds of details that it's just impossible to capture. You know what I mean, in the day to day. But the other thing is that having this constant thing, this constant conversation, this ongoing conversation, I think it allows us to know. You know, again, what Israel and the U.S. want us to feel like is this is just another day of violence in Palestine. You know, for people who deserve violence. That is the way that they think about this. That is the whole idea of normalizing that kind of violence. And that's what mainstream media coverage looks like. Another sad day in Palestine. And the truth is, this violence doesn't stand still. It's not the same every day. It keeps moving. They are trying to innovate new ways of colonizing Palestine as a pilot, by the way, for colonizing lots of people. And so by having this constant conversation, you allow us to track that. I just want to honor that, you know, because there's a way that mainstream coverage pays attention to what they would see as sort of exceptionally violent days. And by having this constant conversation, we're acknowledging that it is constant violence, but it is violence that doesn't stand still.
I promise when I get my line of question, you said, but you know, the narrative of Western powers, right? These are people that deserve violence. And it just hit me that we're coming up on the 1 year. You may remember me telling you about the explosive fight I had with my family member over Palestine in this small family-owned Mexican restaurant at my father's birthday party, where you would think I'd never talked about Palestine. Like, I didn't have a fact, I didn't have a figure, I didn't have anything. I just started screaming, because she said, the reason why I write, because she said, those people like violence. And I mean, this is a black woman. And I just screaming F Zionist at the top of my, like, how not to have the conversation about Palestine. I was like, oh wow, that was almost in 6 days. That will be a year ago, and here we are again. You mentioned something that makes me want to sort of skip around, right? So the United, and that is, like, who designed this peace plan? And for me, then I think about what the consequences are for Palestinians in terms of narrative and protection, should they violate the peace plan. So the United Nations should, right, in the minds of Western power.
Yeah.
The United Nations Security Council on November 17th voted in favor of the plan. They welcomed it with open arms. There was all of this hoopla around how wonderful this is and how great it's going to be for the region. Hamas, who initially did accept the first phase, which was about, right, stopping the violence of the bombing, exchanging the prisoners and bodies of, has rejected the plan, the rest of it, and joined a chorus of other Palestinians. I've been so happy to see Palestinian dissenters tear apart this peace plan and really lift up the fact that this border peace, which will be the Trump-Blair party, Trump-Blair show, as an interim governing body, right? The pointing out the fact that this body's in alliance with Israel, and this is just occupation under another name and with more people doing the occupying, yeah? So where I'm going is Where am I? All of these bodies, Curry, we've had this conversation. They're like every single one of them is a joke. It's all performance, United Nations, everybody. They voted on this while Israel was still bombing, because this is just a few days ago, right? Today's the 24th, less than 10 days ago. They voted on this without talking to actual Palestinians. What does, here's the question, what does world power support for this plan mean for Palestinians, Hamas or otherwise, who continue to resist occupation and colonization?
That's an extremely important question. And I do think it's important to note the ways that other international bodies and, frankly, other parts of the UN have, to my knowledge, kind of for the first time really become contested space, actually, when it comes to the U.S. and its ally getting its way. So I'm talking about the International Court of Justice, you know, the fact that South Africa, global South country with its own deep experience of colonization and apartheid, takes a case to the International Court of Justice and wins. You know, the ICJ says, yes, we think that you're right. We think that there is a plausible genocide here. The UN General Assembly obviously continues to be a space where it's not just, I mean, for many decades, the General Assembly has these lopsided votes where it's more or less the whole world, you know, and then the United States and Israel and a few allies. And what's new and different or whatever is that now a few of those U.S. allies even are like, yeah, we can't face our own people in right. the U.K., even as we are repressing them, you know, in Germany, you know, elsewhere in Europe. We can't do this vote because we will pay for it back home, right? And so I think that that's, I only raise that as context because I think that that points to why this UN Security Council vote, which is one of the most undemocratic spaces of the UN, right? It's not the General Assembly, right? It's not even the International Court of Justice, which has representation for, you know, from rotating representation from other countries, right? This has poor, you know, this has permanent members of the Security Council, obviously the US among them. I think that in a lot of ways, the purpose of this vote is to set back those efforts. Because what those efforts were doing, yes, in the Court of Justice, yes, in the UN General Assembly, but really in the streets of the world, you know what I mean? Like it was on the ports of the world, you know, it was through general strikes in Italy. You know, it was through the flotillas, et cetera, et cetera. And these UN bodies were just one context for registering that. But the world was isolating Israel and increasingly isolating the United States. And that's why this UN Security Council vote is really, it's a win for them. I'm sorry to say it. It's a win for them. It is targeting that isolation. And it is significant that this vote passed the UN Security Council with nobody opposed. It was 13 in favor, 2 abstentions. And one of those in favor, I'm sorry to say, was Algeria, which again has its own deep history of colonization, right? So that was the purpose of this thing. Was to offer legitimacy to this plan that, you, as you rightly pointed out, was absolutely a White House Trump, you know, situation. They are trying to set back all of the important work that the movement has done to isolate Israel and thereby hold it accountable.
All right, I'm clocking time, so I'm going to walk away from Palestine just for a minute, and if we have time, we're going to come back because we got to talk about Lebanon, Curry. We have to talk about another high-level assassination in Lebanon over a leader of Hezbollah. I'm going to let you say the brother's name because I don't want to get it wrong, but I'd like you to say his name and then talk about who he was. And why this is, I mean, there's reasons, there's so many reasons. A, right, there's a ceasefire.
Yeah.
B, this is again an assassination by Israel in a country that's not theirs, and they didn't get permission, right? There's an attack on the Capitol. And then C, so many of Hezbollah's leadership have been murdered by Israel. Go.
Right. Well, let me just say, just by virtue of transition, I want to remind folks that until very recently, whenever we would say that Israel needs to stop this genocide, there was a pro-Israel talking point that is, oh, if only Hamas returned the hostages, all this would stop. And the hostages have been returned, and Israel continues to bomb Gaza and kill literally hundreds of Palestinians since the so-called ceasefire. And what it Hezbollah has not attacked Israel. I mean, this so-called ceasefire has been in effect for almost a year. And there has not been a Hezbollah attack on land, on territory claimed by Israel at all. And yet there have been, I mean, this is a and I, you know, I will spare our listeners my attempt at the Arabic pronunciation of his last name, but his first name is Haytham. You know, that's this Hezbollah leader. You know, that is making news because, again, it is significant, and it is considered kind of exceptional because of an attack in Beirut, in the capital. But Israel's been attacking southern Lebanon every single day. Daily, they've been violating this ceasefire. Again, so-called ceasefire. And I want to, you know, once the ceasefire went into effect, you know, when I say ceasefire, you can't hear it because it's radio, but I'm saying it in quotes. You know, once they signed the ceasefire, agreed to the ceasefire, Lebanese came up with this phrase that is, ceasefire means cease for us and fire for Israel. You know, so when I say that they're redefining ceasefire, the Lebanese got it right away. That's what it looks like. It's a one-sided ceasefire. And I just think, again, the significance of this is Israel's justifying all of its violence rhetorically by saying, well, we're defending ourselves from hostility. There has been no hostility at all from Hezbollah or other forces, you know, from what I can tell, you know, across the border. And yet, not only does Israel violate the ceasefire, but they're escalating it by bombing in Beirut. So, you know, the Israeli conversation is what is that Israel's basically gunning for another opportunity to launch more attacks of the devastating kind that we saw in Lebanon. And we should know, just in terms of Israeli politics and Israeli society, while the question of the genocide in Gaza became controversial, not for the reasons that it's controversial here, and that is the enormous loss of Palestinian life, but for other reasons, attacking Lebanon is not controversial in Israel. Attacking Iran is not controversial in Israel. Attacking Syria is not controversial in Israel. Bombing Yemen is not. So you have an Israeli political establishment and an Israeli society that is fine with attacking Lebanon and all these other countries. So it's extremely dangerous, and it just points to the importance, again, of us demanding an arms embargo to stop Israel, because they will not stop until we stop them.
Curry, remember me and remind my audience about U.S. interest in Lebanon and why perhaps Israel's nonstop bombardment of Israel, despite a so-called ceasefire, might be serving those interests. Hence our silence, other than the occasional, spewing of Trump about the evils of Hezbollah. Other than that, we know, and the evils of, and then we don't hear nothing.
Right. And, you know, Lebanon, it must be said that, Lebanon has been sought after by regional and world powers for centuries, actually. You know, the nature of its terrain, it's mountainous, in a way that is unique, means that military powers they wanted to control it. And it was in the early 20th century, it was a key site of the development of the U.S. Empire and the U.S. Marines training. That's why they have, people may know the Marines song that talks about the shores of Tripoli. They're talking about invading Lebanon. And so it has long been a place that the U.S. has wanted to control. Obviously, it was a place that was colonized by France. And when French colonization formally ended, though it has continued in various ways, Israel sought to control Lebanon. Israel propped up its own regime in Lebanon for many years. Israel intervened heavily in the Lebanese Civil War, both to vie for control of the country, as well as, crucially, to kill as many Palestinians as possible, because there are many Palestinian refugees living in camps in Lebanon as well. So there's been a longstanding kind of U.S.-Israeli and really Western project for the control of Lebanon as part of the domination of the Middle East. And that is something, of course, that the U.S. supports Israel carrying out.
And just to help my own edification, I learned so much through our conversations, and Hezbollah is sort of... Not sort of. Hezbollah is the body that has, because there is no strong Lebanese government or strong Lebanese military. The defense has been Hezbollah. Say what you want about them, but that's right, right?
That's right. And to be really short about it, really brief about it, the Lebanese state, again, when France was formally kind of ending its colonization in Lebanon, and Lebanon was transitioning to a certain kind of independence, the Lebanese state was crafted to be a weak state. That was the point, so that there would always be an opportunity for foreign powers, including like France, including like Israel, to say, we can actually be an armed force here. We can play a role. And so Hezbollah really emerged in that context. It emerged in the context of the Israeli intervention. In the context of that civil war. So it was when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982, that was kind of the basis, the context for the emergence of Hezbollah. I think that's extremely important, because there is this notion of forces like Hezbollah or forces like Hamas as though they are these aggressors, and we can talk about the content, the political content, the military content of these organizations, what they do. But the fact is that Israel was occupying Gaza before, like Israel's occupation of Gaza was the context for Hamas's emergence. Israel's occupation of Lebanon was the context for Hezbollah's emergence.
We can go on and say the same thing about Al-Qaeda, right? We can go on and say the same thing about the Black Liberation Army. We can go on, right? And so I think this gets into that conversation, which some people find sticky. I mean, people don't want to talk about it, right? People, right. Certainly not mainstream media, but even people that, sort of sit with the platforms I sit with, they don't want to talk about people's right to armed struggle, people's right to defend themselves, right? And what white supremacy creates, right? And like, people of color, we're all good as long as we sing Kumbaya and hold hands and march peacefully, right? I'll just talk about the movement that besides this work that I'm a part of. As long as we do not burn buildings or break windows or actually develop systems that can protect our communities from the violence of the state, then we're just all good. But the second we say, absolutely not, we're not taking this anymore, right, we're demons and we're vilified. And that's not to say that the actions of Hamas or the actions of Hezbollah have all been above board in line with the principles and integrity that I live my life by. Sure. And I think at some, right, like we have to stop being scared of talking about people's right to self-defense, people's right to protect themselves from the massive military power of Western colonizers.
Yeah, I really take a lead from Palestinian thinkers on this. There's a great brother named Rami Khoury. You know, he's a longtime journalist, Palestinian guy, lived in Lebanon for many years, lived in Jordan for many years, lives in the U.S. now. And he put this really simply. He said, look, colonized people are going to resist. And that resistance takes, this is just part of the deal. It takes political forms, it takes cultural forms, and if the colonization is military, then it will take military forms. That is not something that is unique to Palestinians. That is not something that is unique to, you know, Black folks. That is the nature of colonization. The one thing I will say about, you know, organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah versus like an organization like Al-Qaeda, you know, which is also, we can talk about Al-Qaeda. We can talk about that armed response to, you know, Western colonization and so on. One thing is Al-Qaeda is its sources, people join Al-Qaeda from all kinds of countries, yeah. You know, right? For a certain political project that isn't necessarily rooted in a particular place. Hezbollah is a Lebanese organization.
Yeah,
defending Lebanese land, right? Like that's like, and again, we can talk about Hezbollah. There's plenty of study and scholarship, critical and otherwise, of Hezbollah. But you have to start with the point that these are Lebanese folks defending Lebanese land, and the same thing with Hamas. It's a Palestinian organization. Nobody can join. Nobody can be part of Hamas other than Palestinians. And so it's a Palestinian response to the colonization of Palestinian land. And again, that kind of thing is lost, I think, in the U.S. conversation, because there's this idea that these are just sort of violent forces existed, you know, that are not rooted in a context, but that they're rooted in the context of their land.
Well, it's right. The response of the United States is rooted in the context of how dare you, which is the common refrain when any group of color or marginalized body dares to resist. The response is, how dare you? All right, yeah. If I disappear in the next week, you know, I think we have to continue to find ways to have these conversations.
Yeah, especially because this is a different. I'll just say this is a different conversation elsewhere in the world. I just want to note that. I mean,
say more.
I mean, international law does codify occupied people's right to resist occupation. I mean, that is a part of international law. It has certain rules for that, the way that it has rules for all armed conflict. But, you know, the notion that that there is no right whatsoever, I think it's a very U.S. conversation. I just want to place that.
Right. And I think the last thing I'll say, then we'll go back to news headlines, right, is that is what we mean by when we say white supremacy doesn't work for anybody, even white people. Mm. Right, like there are consequences. But I say to my dude, I say, because there's a teenager, his grandson said, don't use the word consequences, talk about impact. Your choices have impact. Everybody's always telling teenagers about consequences. They have impact, right, is the way we're going to lean into that conversation. Curry, I want to go back to Gaza because we've got more time. My second guest is not going to come, which gave me to have more time with you, which I always find like there's never enough for, and there still won't be enough. We started the show talking about Israel's escalating attacks despite the 20-point plan. And as always, the colonizer has a reason. Oh, wait, but you don't understand. And for Israel, that's always Hamas has done something, right? Hamas has attacked. Hamas is something. There's no proof of that. But that's the line, right? Because going back to the segue is this conversation about the vilification of people who fight back. And they say that a Hamas fighter attacked Israeli soldiers in Israeli-occupied territory inside Gaza's so-called yellow line. What is this yellow line? We keep hearing about this yellow line. What is this yellow line? I doubt it's like painted yellow line. Like, what is it? And my understanding is it keeps moving, this line that they're talking about that people have violated. It's a very special magical line, this yellow thing.
Isn't it interesting how this line keeps moving? I mean, you know, quote unquote, our border, you know, on the U.S.-Mexico border, that, you know, we're going to build a wall across that. I mean, that we're going to make that as real as possible. But the yellow line goes all over the place. So this is, first of all, just a word about color lines, for lack of a better term. You know, Israel, this is an interesting thing that people may or may not know in the U.S., that Israel has not formally ever actually declared its own borders. It's never said these are our borders that we agree to. So that's kind of interesting. There are these lines that they have established that they don't consider borders, but will for the purposes of, I don't know, deciding where they can agree to station their troops and whatnot, and what counts as occupied territory versus the state of Israel. They'll say, okay, we can accept these lines. So you have a green line that outlines the West Bank. You have a blue line on the north with Lebanon, and now there's a yellow line. So this is just to take it back to 1947 real quick for a second. This is the UN partition plan of that time proposed taking the land of historic Palestine and dividing it roughly in half between Arab Palestinians, which is to say Christian and Muslim Palestinians, and then Jewish folks. This is, and I say that because before the establishment of the state of Israel, there were Palestinian Jews. You know, yeah. Those people were forcibly separated, actually, and sort of incorporated in the state of Israel and ripped from their Muslim and Christian neighbors. But the idea, but you know, who are now people who are now considered Palestinians, vastly outnumbered, of course, the majority of the Jewish population, which the majority of Jewish folks were coming in from elsewhere, you know, primarily from Europe. And so this partition plan was about, without any Palestinian representation, sound familiar, to try to divide the land in half, Palestinian land, and also, you know, say, oh, this is fair, we're giving you half, but, you know, not only were there no Palestinians involved, but there's more Palestinians than there were Jewish folks also, right? So that I just put that on the table to say, Palestine has been divided going way back, decades. Then more recently, you know, Israel has come to invade and occupy the West Bank and Gaza. You know, folks will know about the West Bank. Let's talk about that for just 1 second. The West Bank is a place that hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers live. So this is called occupied, it's part of the occupied Palestinian territory, but it is divided, you know, again, by the state of Israel internally by these Israeli Jewish-only settlements.
Did you say hundreds of thousands? Hundreds of thousands?
Hundreds of thousands. Hundreds of thousands.
Isn't it like this big?
It's very small, absolutely, yes.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
There are roads that only Jewish folks were allowed to drive on. I mean, that this is all about slicing up, you know, Palestinian territory. And so then we look at Gaza, which is even smaller than the West Bank. It is a place that Palestinians have called an open-air prison for years prior to this latest chapter of genocide.
Right.
Because you have more than 2 million people confined in a small space.
Right.
And then, as part of this 20-point so-called peace plan, they're dividing that land again. And that is the yellow line. That is Israel saying, we're going to actually, in an indefinite way, station our troops in this part of Gaza, actually. You know, this is why my colleague Phyllis Bennis, you know, she compares this latest plan to the Oslo Accords, which happened in the early 1990s, and the idea was to divide Palestinian territory into three different categories. One category would be controlled by Israeli forces. The other category would be controlled by the Palestinian Authority. And then there'd be this sort of mix, you know, in between. But the point here being, you're taking a tiny part of land, a small portion, a fraction of what Palestinians originally lived in historic Palestine, and then dividing it further. And now they're doing it again in Gaza. So that is the purpose of the yellow line. It is about stealing and occupying more Palestinian land and then justifying more violence by saying, oh, you crossed the yellow line. And now we have the right to what? Carry out airstrikes and kill 23 people.
Including children.
That which has nothing to do with, you know, the supposed attack, which you can't prove because what, by the way, they continue to deny journalists and aid workers the right to even access Gaza. So we can't even independently verify Israeli claims, right? But this is about stealing more land and justifying more violence. That's the yellow line.
Let's talk about the West Bank for a little bit. Human Rights Watch has released a new report and said that the attacks that happened with the launch of Operation Iron Wall in late January amount to war crimes. They say that 32,000 Palestinians were expelled by Israeli forces from three camps in January and February. These folks have not been allowed to return home. We know that that was followed up by then Israel declaring certain neighborhoods military training zones and displacing more, even more people. And then we've got that exacerbated by ongoing and escalating attacks by, as you pointed out, there's hundreds of thousands of them. In my head, there were just thousands of them, maybe tens of thousands of settlers, that there was just an attack on olive harvesting, right? Children, some of them U.S. citizens have been murdered. Like, it is, and how convenient for Israel that so much of our attention has been diverted to Gaza.
That's right. I mean, we should remember, you know, we can think back to before October 2023. Actually, the main news out of Palestine was the escalation in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
This is before you know, the all-out genocidal assault on Gaza. Israel was carrying out what they called these operations in the West Bank, targeting Nablus and other towns. And so this is a continuation of that. That's really important to remember, again, because what they say is everything they do is in self-defense. You know, everything they do is a response to the October 7th attacks. Well, this well predates that. You know, it's not Hamas that Hamas doesn't dominate in the West Bank the way that they've been in power in Gaza. And yet Israel has been carrying out this kind of deepening, intensifying assault on the West Bank for well over 2 years, actually. You know, the other thing that said, again, that also doesn't stand still. You know, like we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, the violence doesn't stand still. And so having done what they have done in Gaza, they are now taking tactics that they piloted in Gaza and using them in the West Bank. You know, so previously they actually weren't carrying out airstrikes in the West Bank. Now they have been. And then, as you point out, this is with the benefit, the Israeli benefit of armed settlers, you know, which don't exist in Gaza, though they want, that's what the settler movement, including government ministers, Israeli government ministers, they want to settle Gaza. They're very open about that. In the West Bank, they are already settling. And so these armed settlers essentially work hand in hand with the Israeli military. They attack Palestinians harvesting olives, as you say, or frankly, doing anything.
Breathing,
you know, like seriously. Palestinians inevitably stand up for themselves. And I don't just mean in an armed way. I mean, literally just refusing to surrender, you know, their land, which serves as a pretext for the formal Israeli forces to step in, you know, and basically protect the settlers. Those weapons, by the way, that the settlers are using, I mean, these are supposedly private citizens, but those weapons are coming from the United States, you know, and the Israeli National Security Minister, am I right, Ben Gavir, himself, a product of the settler movement, he said after October 7th that he was going to pursue a weapons deal with the United States to get more rifles that would be distributed to Israelis. So these are U.S. I mean, you know, I think that we know, we talk about the fact that U.S. weapons are in the hands of the uniformed Israeli forces. But U.S. weapons are in the hands of private Israeli citizens also, which are distributed by the government as they colonize the West Bank. So that is what is happening there.
Which just gives all that more weight. It's going to connect the whole resistance dots here to arms embargo now.
That's right. Exactly. That's what we have. You know, that is the recourse, really, that we need to push on to actually stop this.
Curry Peterson Smith, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for the extra time. Thank you for your brilliance and thank you for your work.
I'm always grateful, Kat.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.